He's open about it because just like anybody that's really good, it's like, yeah, I'll tell you what I use. That doesn't mean you're going to know you're going to do it as well as I do. But just even in that little thing, he was showing me a couple of great tricks with the suspension.
Welcome to the Vintage Euro Podcast for people who love classic European cars and motorcycles from the 1950s to the rad era. Now here are your hosts, Brian Joslin and Miles Levy.
Yeah, might as well, record button there, or just, yeah.
No, I have to say, I've just been pretty happy. You get everything in the front end of a car refreshed, and you realize, wow, I really just got used to it being a lot less less stable than this. It's just an entirely different car now. It's just such a joy.
Yeah.
You know, and that car's not really set up for any kind of hard cornering, but it's precise now. You know, you're bending into a corner and the car's actually eager to do it, and I thought that the car had a ton of torque steer, and it was like, no, it didn't have torque steer, it just had wheels pointing the wrong direction
and bad bushings.
Yeah, just take my hand off the wheel and get into the meat of the turbo boost, and the car just tracks straight. So it's like, okay, you know, I might have spent a little coin on it, but everything definitely works better now. It has a nice firm feel to it. That car never had that. That might be the subframe bushings. There's just something about that now where it just feels really, really direct. I dig it.
Yeah.
I dig it. So, yeah.
Cool. Did you get over to see the Range Rover yet?
Did I get to see it? I saw it.
I mean, I know you saw it last week.
I didn't. That's funny. No, I haven't been over there today. Now, you know, last night was the night the previous owner went to clean it out. I believe he did do that. Pretty sure he did that, because then today my uncle called me because they were finalizing, I told you, this Pennsylvania thing where he had to be at AAA with a notary to get everything signed off. And they said, they just needed the name of the buyer. And then I could sign it whenever I want. And I trust them because obviously my uncle and whatever. So they all have all the paperwork ready for me whenever I finally go get it. Whenever we finally go deal with it. So, but yeah, I mean, I'll see my uncle sometime this week. So whenever we're going to go, you know, grab a little socially distanced lunch, then I'll actually finally start, since it's all cleaned out, then I can just grab the keys and really start poking around in it. So,
yeah,
looking forward to that. And then it'll go, you know, we'll drive about a block away and go into the garage. And then and then I'll buy it a couple of pumps, and then you and I will go attack it. See how that goes. So I'm looking forward to that. I've been on automotive forums talking to some other people about it, and it's just hilarious how some people are like, oh, that's such a cool idea. And other people are like, yeah, you're out of your mind. You're out of your mind. And you just need to get out of it now. But
you're not into it deep enough yet.
No, I know. Someone else suggested something that I didn't think of at all.
Which, an LS conversion.
No, well, they were just, you know, I was like, well, how am I going to get to California? He's like, the thing's got a 7,700 pound, you know, tow capacity. Tow the Volvo out. Right. I'm like, you know, I even said, you know, I say I trust certain year Range Rovers to be reliable. I don't know if I'm going to tow another car across the country reliable. I don't know how I feel about that one. You know, transmission isn't a strong point on that. I don't know. I feel like I'd wind up trying to tow the Range Rover with the Volvo, which would really not work out. So,
we talked about the economics of it. You're probably still better off driving the Volvo home and then paying to have the Range Rover trailered back across the country for a grand or whatever.
Yeah, there's no way that thing's getting more than, what, 9-10 miles to the gallon on the highway if it's pulling the Volvo?
If it's got a U-Haul and a Volvo behind it, no.
Yeah, if it's on a trailer. I mean, even if it was a relatively low friction, just the front wheel dolly situation where the rear wheel's on, but it's still, no, too much drag. Too much drag. So, I don't think I'm going to do that. Yeah, and that just actually didn't sound as much fun. Do I really want to trundle across America at 60 miles an hour with the Volvo behind me?
Really.
Probably not.
I still argue we should get it back on the road. Keep it here. We'll get it all sorted out, and I'll have to just do a cross country trip and deliver it to you.
Well, I don't. You know, that was an idea, and I think it's a good idea. And then again, if you and Jamie did something together, you know. since he's another long haul guy, who knows, right? Or it'd be the two of you, at least. And then,
anything's possible. Yeah.
Just throw that out there.
Drive west to deliver him to a car that we drive home in. A week of my life.
Yeah, that'll be a fun vacation. I'm sure your wife will like that idea, too. So, that's a cool idea. We'll figure that out.
The good news is the little black Range Rover Sport on my desk isn't leaking a drop of oil.
No, it's not, is it? I mean, that's the advantage of not having a motor in it. But
it's only rear wheel drive, actually.
That's funny. You sent me a video of it. You actually found, you already had this sitting around and just work.
We were at the grocery store over the weekend, and I can't pass by those stupid baskets of $6 diecast toys at the supermarket without examining. And there was a black Range Rover Sport there, an L320 Range Rover Sport. And I thought, well, it's black. It's the right generation. It's pretty accurate little depiction. So, yeah, why not? And Kelly laughed at me. She's like, are you serious?
I know, it's
$6. I know. We go through this all the time. Mm. And I brought it home and I sat there and looked at it and went, the interior is not right, though. And started digging around through some of my model, stuff that I had here. One of the last times I was in the UK, I bought Riley an Airfix 1/32nd scale Jaguar E-Type model. I'm sure the molds were made probably in the 60s as well. Poor fitting, ill-fitting plastic with water-based acrylic paints and everything. And I don't really build models at this point in my life anymore, but I do have a couple of them around. And so I didn't have any paints or anything, and I was trying to figure out, how I was going to match up the interior. And I remembered that Airfix kit was still around because we got that like 90% done. It just needs to kind of be wrapped up. Mm. And started digging through there, and sure enough, it had like a light tan paint, and it's actually like almost dead on. I had pictures of your interior.
Oh, man.
And took it all apart and matched it. The headliner matches, the whole deal is like fully pimped out. So
thank you for pimping out a model of the car I just bought. That's actually pretty damn cool. So
yeah. When you get license plates for it, we'll fix that too. Wrong wheels, but I'm not going to complain.
Well, we got to figure that, we got to figure out whether we're holding with those or not. So, that's a couple moves down the road. So,
yeah.
Oh,
next task is to find a 1/32 scale Weimaraner.
That's, you're right. He has to be in the back window, licking the side glass or whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever he's doing. Perfect. Yeah. Now that you bring that up, I mean, I seem to be trying to live some kind of like elite royal existence between the dog and the Range Rover. So, it's all an illusion.
as long as you know it, right?
Yes. As long as it's not a lack of self-awareness. It's a good point.
Yeah.
It's a good point. But again, I'm excited. I mean, and that's despite all, it's so funny. We'll be talking about that a little bit on this one, about how we like tearing into cars. There's just something about, at this point in my life, wrenching on the car makes it feel much more my own than almost anything else I do. It's not enough to just buy it. I gotta get my hands on it and in it to make it feel like it's my possession. So
yeah, I totally get that. So let's take a quick break here. When we come back, we will we'll dive in, because we've each spent the last couple of days with mutual friends of ours. I mean, friends of both of ours, helping out with some other projects, and we were going to share that. But take a quick break. When we come back, we'll dig into that and
all right,
move on.
Sounds good.
Hey, this is Brian from the Vintage Euro Podcast. I just wanted to say we really appreciate you listening to this episode, but we'd be thrilled if you'd hit the subscribe button to automatically receive new episodes in your playlist as soon as they're released. We publish every Thursday, and we'd hate for you to miss a single show. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram and Facebook as well to stay connected with all the Vintage Euro photos, events, and articles we can't cover in the podcast alone. You can find us on either platform under the handle Vintage Euro, that's VINTAGEURO, or visit VintageEuro.com.
That's Vintage Euro. But remember, there's just one E.
All right, we're back.
Yes.
And Miles is no longer texting. We needed a text break, apparently.
I tried to get that done. Apparently, I'm not multitasking very efficiently right now. So,
no worries. Yeah, so over the weekend, I got to spend time with our friend Jamie Orr, who runs Orchid Euro. And he's been a guest on the show, and we've known Jamie from the Volkswagen scene for years. Trying to arrange a photo shoot with Tim, who you spent today with. We'll get to Tim in a minute too. And Tim's got the Lancia Delta Integrale, and we thought it'd be cool to get that car together with Jamie's Rally Golf. And that couldn't quite work in the time frame that we tried to force it
right
upon it.
But, for various reasons. We were trying to get it done. Yeah. It's too bad. And I would also mention that that Lancia, I mean, we love it. I love it. You love it. That when you posted that up on our social media, it got a lot of attention. There's just people are really aware of that car right now.
And
if you like small hot hatches, it lives up to the hype. And, I'm such a committed L.A. Canyon, Angeles Crest guy. But I was telling you, I forget. That car is perfect for those western suburb, like mainline twisty roads that kind of rise and fall in the gentleman's farms out there on the western edge of the suburbs. And, if you like U.K., B roads, these are those. They're twisting and turning through dense underbrush. You're just flying along, and it's that car is, it's narrow, it's quick, and it's direct. So boy, is that good. So now I have never driven a Golf Rally, of course. I don't know.
Neither have I. We were hoping to do a little back-to-back maybe, and that just unfortunately couldn't happen. And yeah, I think Jamie was being nice, telling us that it wasn't running. But I think it was just, quite frankly, it was just buried in the middle of his shop. It was going to be impossible to get out. In talking to him, it sounds like that he's got some fine tuning he wants to do. It may not be in perfect condition, but it looked fine. We had tried to arrange that, and he couldn't quite make that happen. And I felt bad. He said he had was going to be over at the shop the day we wanted to shoot, but was kind of knee deep in projects. And so I decided, I'll just offer my hand. If he's knee deep in projects, I'll just offer my hand, and we can hang out and talk a bit, and get close to the car a little bit, and at least check it out, and we'll make arrangements for another time to do the shoot. But ended up being a great day over there. He was
for our listeners that don't know who that is, let's point out that this guy really specializes in Volkswagens, and more to the point, Volkswagens that are not normally available in the United States, even though his shop is in suburban Philadelphia. And he's Orchid Euro, if you look that up on Instagram. It's his stuff is so good, and he's so great.
So the Rally Golf was parked next to his Golf Country, which is another exotic golf, if there's such a thing as an exotic golf. There are, as a matter of fact, apparently, and two of them are parked in his garage. He's got some bizarre stuff there. He's got some Mark Ones. He's got an early the Swallowtail, the earliest version of the Mark One Golf. He's got a Golf Taxi prototype that was done with Checker Cab Company. The car's been around for a while, but he has that in his possession. He's kind of the purveyor of unusual golfs. And so we weren't working on anything that interesting. He has an employee that had picked up a fairly cheap Jetta and needed to do an engine transplant. It wasn't running on all five cylinders. It was a 2007 or something, and just needed some muscle. I was as close as he got, but he had a system down, and I don't know. I get over there about 10 o'clock and started working. We had to dig the engine out of the middle of one part of his warehouse and get it around to the back part of his warehouse where he was working. So while his employee and I were making quick work of that. He was tearing into things, disconnecting, getting all the coolant and all the fluids out. And I have to say, I hung around until about 2 o'clock. So I was only there over there 4 hours. We got the old engine transmission completely out of the car, down on the ground. And he was going to switch transmissions over, I believe. But he's got it down to a pretty solid system. He knows what he's working with there. And it went really, really quick. I thought we might get halfway through that. And he's like, oh, no, we'll have this out of here by 1 o'clock or so. And we probably would have if it weren't for wheel locks with no keys.
Man.
So, you know, it's always the little things, the smallest things, that hold you up. But once we had the wheel lock situation under control, which involved destroying a socket and using an impact wrench to spin them off.
That's right.
It went really, really fast. But yeah, we got to hang out for a bit. And it's always good to connect with Jamie. He's a really, really good guy. And always fun snooping through his, through his collection of stuff. I mean, we just talk stories about some of the cars that were there. He's got a Renault Twingo that's his personal car. He had just brought in a 95 Golf Wagon. It was really interesting. Find one owner
taxi
car.
Taxi color, yeah. And it was that crazy.
The taxi color, yeah.
Yeah.
He ordered it that way. And to hear him tell it, the family said that the older gentleman who bought it said he wanted a white car, but not a boring white car. So he ended up with European taxi, whatever the ivory. Which is color. Yeah, there's a formal name for it, but arguably a duller version of white than white.
if possible, yes.
Yeah, but really neat car. I forget how many miles are on it. Super, super low mileage, in immaculate condition. It was really neat to see, brought back memories of my 94 Golf that I bought new. It still sounded and smelled a lot like that brand new Golf that I bought. But he's got all kinds of neat stuff over there. Double cab transporter, what we would call a Vanagon, except it's a pickup, a flatbed. Man, he's just got so much cool stuff.
Right.
Parts and parts and parts. It's just unbelievable.
Well, it's an interesting dichotomy. Like he has such a love for that stuff that most people, it's really for us serious Euro car geeks, especially that ever grew up on the Volkswagens, and we go nuts for it, and other people might wonder about it. But it's funny because I feel like he's always had that, but it's really, lately in the last few years where these things are really, appreciated. And we're also at the point where guys of our age, these are the cars that we love that we couldn't get a hold of, and now he's the perfect guy to go to if you want to grab them. So. Yep. That's who I'm going to. I'm like, okay, I need you to find me a good one. And it's like, if it's out there, he's going to find it. So.
Yeah. I mean, I heard some nightmares of, some things that have gone wrong, but he, for the most part, he's acted as a buffer, between, well-intentioned American buyers and unscrupulous sellers sometimes. And he's avoided a lot of problems, but he alone has fallen victim to him as well. It can happen to anyone. So, good day talking. The MGF came up because we were talking about that prospect. Oh, really? And he said, he's been giving some thought to that as well. He's been looking at the right-hand drive cars. An interesting conversation. He said they're half to two-thirds of the cost of the ones in Germany. They're just more plentiful in the UK.
Well, that's interesting.
And a lot of them there were sold with hard tops, which I've yet to come across a German ad that included a hard top. And he said the hard top doesn't seem to add anything to the cost. Like some have them, some don't, but they're all about the same money. So he's looking at probably a right-hand drive hard top maybe at some point in the near future. And he doesn't think he can get hurt too badly on a right-hand drive MG because, the novelty of it. So So it'll be interesting to see. I don't know if his time frame is the same as what I'm looking in the, right. in the mid-spring, late spring, but we'll have to see. And I had the conversation with Kelly about it, so that's it's out in the open now that
you've laid the groundwork for it to be a possibility. But I'll tell you, even if I wasn't looking at British cars, and I'm sure that's a great reason if they, you know, if you got the same car that's just got, you know, the price is like significantly less just because it's a right hooker. But I was thinking, you know, it wouldn't even necessarily need to be a British car that I would want. Just the idea of if we're already doing this, why not do something really interesting like a right-hand drive, whatever, right-hand drive Porsche or right-hand drive BMW or Mercedes. It just automatically makes it, you know, just a little something different. Now, of course, on narrow East Coast roads, I feel like that, you know, especially that is a bit of a liability since you're on the wrong side of the car for obvious reasons. But it's still it's tantalizing, you know. If we're looking for something that gives us a little extra thrill, I mean, for me alone, trying to shift with my left hand just screws everything up. So that's a challenge that it would be interesting to go to as opposed to, you know, shifting across my body with my right hand, which is the way the first time I did it, that was how I handled it. But, you know.
Hey, you know, we're not getting younger. They're always talking about brain elasticity. So you need those challenges.
Okay, well, then maybe, yeah. I think I saw some dust. I saw some pulling out of my ear there. Apparently it was an earwax. But that would be, just like doing a crossword puzzle, it probably would be better for our overall health. You're right.
Yeah. I know, when my dad lived in England, he was there for 3 years in the military. He and my stepmom could never get used to the turn signals. Which I believe are all the stocks are the same arrangement, if I remember correctly. But they had like a dyslexia from being on the other side of the car. They could never quite work the right stock.
That kind of makes sense. That makes sense. If you've just decided that everything is the reverse and then that one thing isn't, I could see how sometimes in some situations your brain might have a hard time processing that one anomaly in the whole thing. That makes sense.
Yeah. They had Mazdas the whole time. They were over there, a little 323 and a 626. And it could never. Every time we were out, it seemed like they turned on the windshield wipers to make a turn. So, obviously, I'm sure they got over that eventually. But I remember it being a big deal for a long time for them.
Cool. Well, it's a thought. And in the meantime, in Jamie's shop, obviously he's got a bunch of candy in there. What was the one that was in there that you really thought, boy, that's the one I'd like to kind of have for a while? Which one?
Well, you know, he's got a couple of the Golf Harlequins, which were the four color mix-up. And so he's got a couple of them there. I don't know if they're his or their customers or donor cars or what. We didn't really get into the Golf Harlequins. Those were sold here in the States. I think 96 was the year they offered those. But he actually has a European market Polo Harlequin, which was the concept, I think, that may have preceded this. So I don't know how old that one was, but it's in the picture that I took in the shop there. I mean, he has a right-hand drive Mark I GTI, a later one, which is intriguing. It's not in phenomenal shape, but I believe that's also his personal car that he had eyes on a project. I'm trying to think now what he had there that I can talk about. He's got a lot of stuff under covers, so it's hard to know what was under there. I've seen some of the projects before, though. The double cab, T3 was definitely pretty cool, though.
Nice.
Yeah.
Doesn't our boy Paul Grimes have one of those too, somewhere out there in Arizona?
I think he still has it, the red 15 years.
Yeah, I think he does still have it.
The Doka, the red Doka.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. TriStar. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, so that sounds like a fun time with Jamie. Now
it was a good day. I wrenched my back, though. I have to say, I realized I'm not getting older or any younger because we were moving pallets of engines and transmissions to get to the stuff we needed to get to, and the guy that's helping him was. He's a slight guy. he might be 100. He's a really, you know, he's a really, really thin guy and a lot younger. He just didn't have the bulk I did to move pallets of engines and stuff around. And I, at some point, twisted something really bad. I'm still feeling it. So it's, It's no fun getting old.
No, no. I hear you on that. Well, that's why. Yes, that's why you do lead the youngins. But yeah, you were about to, sound like you're about to say he's a lightweight. But yeah, he was a, he's a smaller kid, right? So
he literally was. He just he's a you know. I don't want to stereotype in any way, shape, or form. He's just a small guy. You know, he's like maybe 5'8", maybe 90 pounds, 100 pounds. He's just a younger, you know, skinny jean kind of guy.
Right. Right.
And yeah, well, I'm not.
No, especially as I've been back, I was going through a bunch of my old clothes. I was like, I fit in that? Oh, okay. Yeah, maybe I need to do a little more working out here. Well, the stuff you were doing was a little bit different than what I was doing today.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. And other end of the spectrum in every way, shape, and form.
Well, that's, yes. Yeah. So my lovely buddy Tim McNair at GP Concours actually called me and asked me for some help because he was going to work on a 1974 Ferrari 365 GT4 Berlinetta Boxer, which is only one of the prettiest cars that I've ever seen. But the deal was, they were doing a full engine out refresh on the car, and the owner wanted the engine bay completely cleaned up while the engine was out, which is always smart. But they wanted to get the engine back in the afternoon, so Tim wanted me to come by and help him out so that he could, you know, get everything done that he wanted to get done before they started trying to mount the engine back in. Quite honestly, part of that involved working on the wheel well. So what we actually did was Tim actually got in, you know, the car was up on a lift. So the car had the car lifted up, and then Tim sat with everything at eye height in the actual engine bay while I worked on the wheel wells and everything in there since the wheels and everything was out of it. This place we were in, it's called Scuderia Performante in Malvern. And yeah, much like Vintage Motorsports, where I had the Volvo the other day, it was nothing but amazing stuff. There was a Mura S in there, you know, there was a 458, there was a 355, there was a 430, you know, all the V8s, a couple different of the V12 cars. And then of course I've always had this thing, and you know, it's just on the edge of the Vintage Euro, but I have a thing for the 550 Maranello. I always have. I actually like the front engine V12 cars a lot. To me, the Gentleman's Express GT, just a 2+2, they seem more under the radar somehow than the mid-engine cars, the supercars, and I just love them. But sure enough, and we've talked about this on the podcast, my favorite color pretty much in all the world on a car, nothing looks bad on it, is midnight blue. So, of course, they have not one, not two, but three 550 Maranellos sitting around, one of which was absolutely a midnight blue. I'm actually pulling up Tim's. Tim told me what the color is called. It's like Pozzi blue, I think it's called. Like pizza, but long O. Pozzi. Named for Charles Pozzi, the race car driver and broker. So this was a color named after one of Ferrari's clients. And it had the Bordeaux interior, which is like the deep red interior. And of course, this one had the manual really classic transmission. Combination. Yes. So blue with the red, with the clackety clack, you know, the gate, gated shifter. And I was like, okay, there, that's it. That's my... I've got all the money in the world I need. I don't even want one of the $1 million supercars. That's the one in that color combination that I would have if I had a Ferrari. And it was immaculate, of course. But you know, Tim and I had to get the work done pretty quickly. But it really was. I was working on, like I said, in the wheel wells of that five of the Berlinetta Boxer. You know, that car has dual rear shocks, the nickel cad plated. Brake caliper, and you know, I'm just all cleaning everything out and, you know, making the car look brand new, which wasn't hard. There was dirt, but there wasn't, you know, it wasn't like the car was splashing through a winter in Western Philly or something like that. So but it's a joy to look at something like that, you know, and especially they removed the clamshell back, so, and it was completely out of the way where it couldn't be damaged, so the whole back end of the car was exposed. And you're looking at some of the typical, you know, fixes that some people do. Yeah. You know, like the exhaust hangers, one side was rubber, the other side was poly. It was like, okay, we got to fix that. You know, make that a little more. Yeah. You know, some interesting, you know, the slings and arrow of any car that's, you know, from 1974 where you want to get some stuff done. But it's nice to be able to focus. And again, it's the lift. You know, the car was right at my eye height, so I could really get in there with some good snap-on, you know, magnet lights, put wherever I needed them, and just really get everything cleaned up and tightened up. You know, and working with Tim in there is great. You know, he had his Audi Allroad full of all of his stuff, all these stackable boxes, like shelving. He just rolls it into the shop, and then we've got everything we need, every little tool, every little cleaning apparatus, all the different kinds of cleaners that won't do any damage. And, you know, I'll post, there's some good before and after shots of the engine bay. It's just, like we were saying, I mean, you and I love driving as much as anything. I love good competition. I love driving hard, but I get so much satisfaction out of just getting something put together correctly and cleanly. So
yeah,
I was having a good old time. So yeah,
I used to be that. I mean, I never took engines out to detail, but used to be that meticulous about, you know, maintaining a car, and I kind of miss having one I care that much about, to be frank. But the old days of Q-tips on the door hinges and things like that, just to keep things clean.
Oh God, yeah. I mean, we got that from Larry Evans. I mean, I would wash my car in the rain. I didn't have to dry it, but if it was raining, it was a perfect opportunity to get all the junk off and just let it sit in the rain and rinse off. So that was people looking at you in a raincoat like, this guy's out of his mind. But to me, it was a missed opportunity if you didn't. So.
Yeah, I liked clay in my car in the rain. Once it was, I mean, obviously with it clean first, you know, washed, but you know, you had a never ending stream of surface lubricant there to keep things moving, and never had to spray. You can make fast work of it if you washed it and let it go out in the rain.
Right. But this
is, I think that was one of the fun things about working with Larry, though, is we learned some of those bizarre kind of. Not that was a Larry Emmons thing. That was something I just kind of picked up. But some of the processes that, I don't know, they've stuck with me because that's kind of the only way I can detail a car now. You know, like we always started by taking the wheels off, right? We always front, back, fender liners, everything. The car went up on jack stands to do a proper detail.
Well, yes. Once you've done that, it would just annoy you. You couldn't feel like you finished the job if you hadn't pulled the wheel off and really gotten everything clean through there. Isn't that true at this point?
I haven't done one of those details in a long time, but it's one of the reasons I haven't is because I don't feel like I've really done a detail until I've done it at that level. There's a big difference between cleaning a car and detailing.
Right. I have to say the main thing I've still taken from him, though, is that I don't use machine, like people that use like orbital buffers and stuff like that. Like, I just really believed in his philosophy of you only take off as much as you need. I mean, it's always going to be easier to use an orbital buffer on stuff, but I'm such a fan of hand work because I know I'm doing as little damage and removal of paint as possible when I get it done that way. And I know there's a lot of detailer guys who would probably tell me to, you know, stay in my lane, and I don't know what I'm talking about. But it really hit home with me that it's like, yeah, of course it's always going to look good, but that's because you're taking more off than you have to. And I don't want to do that. So, yeah.
It helps if you stay on top of it from the beginning or have it, you know, if it occasionally needs a super rough cut to get it back to good, you know, to maintain it though, you know, and I imagine most of what Tim's dealing with are cars that don't see a lot of environmental damage, like a daily driver would.
No, they don't. That's where, now, you know, Tim's genius comes in, how to make something that's already good look even better. And he freely, openly calls them tricks. But he knows how to pull your eye to certain things and what cleaners to use on certain materials so that it always looks its best. And, you know, that's important when you're working on, you know, a $300,000 Berlinetta Boxer. And, you know, there's a lot of aluminum and stuff underneath the car and in the engine compartment. And you just want to make sure you're using something that's not going to discolor anything. I mean, that's so important on that car.
Ruining a finish is way worse than you know, leaving it dirty in appearance, but accurate. You know, I mean, I think a lot of owners, I always used to rail against the shiny, you know, stuff. Everyone wanted a shiny. Shiny's easy. Mm-hmm. Deep is hard to come by, you know, right. And correct depth as well, you know, not making it, super glossy, especially plastic trim and things like that. You know, not everything needs to be shiny.
No.
So.
I won't 303 rant. Protectant on the interior. That's what I remember. People would complain. It doesn't last long. It's like, yes, it's because it's not grease.
It's not Armor-All. Armor-All will be there forever.
Right.
If you want something to last.
I used to see people. I'd be like, just look, when you have breakfast, save your bacon grease. Just slap it on there and you'll be fine. So, Yeah.
Well, I bet you learned some stuff working with Tim. I have no doubt. He's seen so many different cars that we, you know, have never seen up close the way he has. So I'm sure he's got an answer for everything.
He does. They let him work on, you know, multi-million dollar cars from the 30s where you absolutely cannot do any damage. And he's learned a couple things in that. He really does with the Italian stuff. He just seems to really know where their weak spots are, and that's really important with some of those older Ferraris. You really, mm-hmm. you know, when I'm under there on the frame, there's only certain cleaners that you're allowed to use under there because other stuff's just going to start getting things flaking off if you're not careful. And he had a couple of things. He talked about it on our podcast with them. I mean, he's open about it because just like anybody that's really good, it's like, yeah, I'll tell you what I use. That doesn't mean you're going to know you're going to do it as well as I do. But just even in that little thing, he was showing me a couple of great tricks around the suspension with some different kinds of brushes and things that really just you get everything going the right direction. It's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was rewarding.
Did you get to stick around long enough to see the engine go back in?
I couldn't. I wound up leaving before they were doing that, and then he had to button up. But that was the thing. If I'd stayed all afternoon, I had to get back and get some other stuff done. So I spent the entire morning with him. But that's mm-hmm. the thing. We spent the entire morning doing all the clean out of just the wheel wells and the engine bay.
Wow.
So, yeah. just those three, the two rear wheel wells and the engine bay, and that was two of us attacking that for about 3.5 hours. So that gives you an idea of what level of kind of work we're doing on it. And
the rest of the car looked like it was amazing. Like it kind of only needed an engine detail, right?
That was the rest of the car was in really good shape. Even the wheel wells were in good shape. There was just little stuff that I had to do. But yes, it was one of those things where the rest of the car looked great, but once you have the engine out of it, that's where you see oil blow by and whatever the heat shield up against the bulkhead has some, you know, you need to give that a little bit of sharpening and cleaning up. So I agree. The rest of the car was in fantastic shape. And we wanted to remove the rear wheels were still sitting on the axles, even though they weren't actually attached to a transmission since I was out of the car. But then, you know, the guy that runs the shop gets out the great knockoff hammer for the to get the wheels off. It's got those great spindles and the spinning bolts. I just, you know, those wheels on the Berlin Auto Boxer are some of my favorite. There's just that certain kind of old mag that Ferrari had on those that looks, I don't think anything gets better looking than that. So, yeah, I mean, I'm geeking out. I was enjoying just the act of taking the wheels off of the car because it was just that old style knockoff hammer. So, good stuff. Very good stuff.
That suspension looks amazing too. I'm just looking at the pictures you were sending earlier.
I didn't know it was running two dual shocks.
Dual coilovers.
Now, when you have a car apart like that, you do start to think of all the different ways that things have advanced. You know, that's a pretty rudimentary setup. It's boxed. The chassis mm-hmm. is like boxed steel melded together, but you realize the car has dual fuel tanks on either side of the motor, and they're mounted directly behind the seats on either side of the car, right up against the wall, the outer wall. So, you know, these days you're so used to all the different ways they have, like, you know, side impact stuff. And it's basically any side impact in that car would involve absolutely shattering the fuel and causing a large fire. So I was like, oh, that's an interesting place to have that. It's not like there's anywhere else you could put it in that car. But you do kind of. I guess I just smile at the idea of just kind of courting disaster. But that's, you know, hey man, that's the '70s. We weren't trying to save ourselves from every little 5 mile an hour thing at that point, or didn't even know how to yet. So, but boy, it was everything about it. And then, you know, the shifter itself, it's just that long wand up to the round ball through the gated shifter.
I always loved that car for the black lower body portion. Yeah. You know, the split. Mm-hmm.
And this one had it.
Very distinct look. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, the BB512 has some interesting differences that I like, but obviously it's not that different than the GT4 BB. Good stuff. Very, very good stuff. I drool. So,
lucky you.
It did get us thinking about value of them. I just start looking when you're looking around any of those good shops and you realize that, you know, you're easily into the seven digits in terms of the value of the cars that are sitting there. You do have to start dreaming big if you want to figure out what you're going to do to get one of those things. But, they seem attainable when they're sitting right there, I think.
Well, they may seem attainable. I mean, that's a bona fide investment car at this point, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, all the BBs.
Isn't any Ferrari at this point just a ridiculous a positive investment?
I don't follow numbers as much, but. You know, I think it's hard to go wrong with anything from that era.
Well, none of them will ever go down at this point. Well,
it's hard to imagine a time when they will. But
right.
Everything has its day. Right now, those are hot as hell. So,
yeah.
Meantime, yes.
But this was related to our next thing because again, and this was from talking about car values. Meekum last week.
Yeah.
Had at Kissimmee, they had their auctions going, and as it turns out, they had we were trying to look up, I couldn't find the exact thing, but it was one of their biggest. They made over 110 million on it. They had a couple of interesting cars. They had an old Carroll Shelby. Actually, Carroll owned this particular Shelby. It was a really gorgeous, the gray one that was his. Sold for a substantial amount of money, but more it was just the overall sense that, as we've been talking about with the car business, that values are going up on everything right now. So we seem to have gone through whatever rise we're going through before COVID, and then COVID had accelerated, and now it's still trending upwards, and that's fascinating to me. All the stuff that we love, it just keeps going up. So, what do you think about that? Is there something you think you better grab? what do you need to get before it becomes unattainable at this point?
Oh man, there's, I don't know. To me, I think still an E30 M3 is. I still see those climbing, and that's a car that I would very, very much love to own. You know, I'm still in the six figure mindset, and you know, those are unattainable for me right now, obviously, as well. But I can't put myself in the 7 and 8 figure bracket and be realistic about it. But on the near horizon, you know, something along those lines, E30 M3. I mean, there's Porsches are always kind of blue chip, you know, stuff as well, but they're not escalating at the rate that's, you know, I think Ferrari for sure.
Right.
I haven't really followed Lamborghini. Lamborghini is not really something that's ever been in my wheelhouse. If I'm going to go Italian exotic, I'm more probably leaning toward Ferrari anyway, but an early Countach would be cool.
Oh, well, the early absolutely no yeah. wings or anything
could be. Yeah.
Yeah.
LP 400, yeah. Yeah.
But listen, on the realistic stuff, I mean, it looks like, you know, air-cooled 911s actually seem to be the one thing that have seemed to have kind of crested, and they're still, maybe they're coming down just a little bit. Yeah. And there's a part of me that thinks that might be the time to grab that. But again, we've talked about this before. The 124 chassis 500E, I really feel like I need to keep an eye out for a good one of those, because there's just going to be a certain point where they're just not going to be attainable at all. So, those are the more reasonable ones that I was thinking about. Yeah. Yeah.
Still like an old Aston. I mean, if I'm going to go old and kind of upper end, you know, an Aston Martin appeals to me. I don't really watch the auction values. I tend to be more of an emotional than a logical kind of enthusiast. I don't look for what's on the rise and calculate how long I can hold on to it before I need to flip it and get out.
There's that, right.
Yeah. I'm not in that part of the market. McLarens are F1, right? Mm-hmm. Still a super hot car, always will be.
You had me thinking, I keep looking, Alfa GTV6s are something that's super affordable that I just, there's something about them. They're so 80s. They're kind of there's an awkwardness to the greenhouse a little bit on the side.
Yes.
The back window seems a little long.
It's care. A huge back, yeah, back quarter window. Yeah. What is it? Part of it slides Part of it rolls down. Part of it's fixed.
Right.
And then it's just a bizarre greenhouse for sure.
Yeah, because there's no way they could make it all of it work with all of that glass where something would even move. They had to make a portion of it fixed for it to work. And the early versions of that were four cylinders, but Alpha six cylinder always had this incredible tone to me that I would love to hear on a regular basis, or maybe do something really like interesting, you know,
2.5 or 3 liter V6 in that. Mm-hmm. And it's got the inboard disc brakes in the rear. It's a cool little car. Yeah. Yeah. I've given thought to one of those. I just know, I guess, you know, I can't really speak as a Land Rover owner, but I've heard, you know, nightmares about owning those and worked at an Alfa dealership. So, you know, I've seen it firsthand as well, just how temperamental those can be. But that seems like it would be a rewarding car to drive, if not to own, maybe.
Right. I'll tell you another near affordable classic there I was thinking about. We were talking about like the early 70s Jaguar XJ sedan, but in the two-door. Mm-hmm. I've seen some of those early two-door coupes, especially with the slimmer European bumpers, because the greenhouse in that car is so airy. The pillars are so slim in that car, but so exquisitely detailed. It's one of the most elegant things I've ever seen. Like
it is.
There's just something about it that just exudes that sense of being at one with yourself and the world and just kind of gliding through whatever may come with this unflappable sense of carrying on in that British way. It's gorgeous. So that's another one that where I was thinking, you know, if you grab one of those now, I you know, Jaguars never go skyrocketing up in the same way that their
German
or Italian counterparts do. But again, who cares, right?
Yeah. Oh, well, to a point, you know, you don't want to end up upside down in one and financially, or with a thin greenhouse, probably literally either. You know, they don't escalate quickly. They're nice cars, but they, especially the XJ coupes just really don't seem to have a big market value on them.
Right.
So, yeah, and, you know, like everything from the 70s out of England, it's, you know, rust is a major concern. Cars, though. Great-looking cars.
But I'll tell you something that you and I are going to wind up dealing with, because, you know, I said we were going to wind up putting my the Range Rover Sport in the garage. The thing I think I mentioned to you briefly was that garage has been occupied by it's a two-car garage that they never use, except the other car that's in there has been in there for years and hasn't moved. And that's a 1968 Series 1.5 XKE Roadster.
Right.
That he's owned now for, I want to say, at least 30, 35 years. And I don't think I don't think it's moved in the last 20 minimum. Hmm. And it's just something he wound up not really liking using it, but he wanted to keep it for his son. And that's my cousin. And I just don't think he's terribly interested in it. But that, you know, he had a full restoration on the car way back in the day, but now it hasn't moved. So I'm sure it probably needs something, but it is, I guess I couldn't call it a barn find, but it's a kind of a garage find or a known garage thing. So it'll be interesting. I mean, when we go to work on the Range Rover, it'll probably be worth everybody's while to kind of see what kind of condition the Jaguar is in, because, you know, it's a really nice one. And I like the 1.5. The Series 1 are the ones everyone loves. 1.5 isn't too bad either.
Yeah.
Still got the straight six, slightly more modern, like switch gear and stuff like that.
It's a Roadster or Coupe?
It's a Roadster. It's a Roadster.
Yeah.
Which I actually think I prefer them personally. I don't know about you.
I'm on the fence. I mean, I really dig the rear door, the hatch door on the coupes.
Yes.
Just because it opens sideways, it's kind of a cool thing. I dig that. But I think the essence of that car is really a Roadster.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. I agree. It's just sexy, and it's a great. And I have been in that car in the summer on a nice breezy day, and it's a nice place to be. Right? So I would hope it would be worth somebody. If I don't know what he wants to do with it or what my cousin wants to do with it, but it seems like, boy, if you guys don't want it, you could make a nice chunk of change, and then somebody else would really benefit from having it. So,
yeah, I mean, I think any E-type Roadster that's already been restored and has been garage kept for the last 20, 30 years is probably going to find a buyer if nothing else happens with it. It'd be cool, if your cousin's not interested in it at some point, maybe you're able to pick that up and save it. That would be an awesome grab.
dare to dream on that one. I'll just go ahead and take it. We're not doing anything with it. Yeah, we'll see how that goes. So,
Yeah.
Well, maybe we can rekindle their interest in it with our enthusiasm once we get into it. So,
Yeah. Well, it'd be interesting to get over there and see it.
Well, that's the thing. It's going to happen. And that's it. I don't know. Will this one be a short one, Brian? I feel like we covered what we wanted to cover this week. So, well, I'll talk about we've been getting our hands dirty on stuff, and that's what hopefully we'll continue to get to do that. So, And then we'll bring in some people. Might want to bring in Tim one of these next couple of weeks, along with our other guests that we have, just so we can kind of bring ourselves up to speed on some things going on. But that's what we got going on this week. So.
Yeah, so we'll probably get together next weekend and have some new things to talk about, if nothing else.
Well, for sure.
Yeah. Till then, I guess we'll call it a short one this week, and we'll be back next week with a new episode.
Sounds like a plan, Brian. Thank you.